We will call the meeting of House Education to order. I'd like to welcome everybody back. During the interim, I missed this time. I'll let the record reflect that it's 8:08, Monday, January 23, 2012. Encourage everybody to turn your cell phone off, spare yourself the embarrassment. We do have a quorum. Present are Representative Feige, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson. Representative Kawasaki is previously excused, and Vice Chairman Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Alan Dick. Major issues we're going to deal with this this session is educational funding is a huge issue for all of us. We're going to speak to the intervention, how the state and the department have been relating to intervention school districts. I think there's a desperate need to address the issue of state standards and in our relationship to them. And if we have time, with all the other things we deal with, I would like to look down the road. I'd like to discuss the school maintenance priority process. There were some questions, and I believe it'd be good for everybody to have dialogue on that. Distance delivery, education, the count date. There's some issues that really need clarifying there. And changing the metric by which we assess both the districts and the students, and the 70-30 statute that speaks to how much money spent on instruction and how much money is available for other other issues. So, but we do want to have this. We do want to have our purpose is certainly to address bills, but we do want to have some just hearings and creating awareness of what's going on with education in the state. Big issue. So. Good to everybody back. We do have one bill on the agenda today, and I would like to move this out of committee. We have HB 145, K-12 Scholarship Program. We do have a committee substitute for HB 145. Representative Pruitt, will you move the CS version Y, Yankee, dated 1-21-12? Will you move that?
I move... The House Bill 145, version Y, for purposes of discussion.
Okay. No, Jack, for purpose of discussion.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
No, I'm just, it's open, and I just want to hear the discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, with the sponsor, Representative Keller, please come forward and present the bill and introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. This bill has been before you now for a while, and so I'm not going to make a real long appeal for school choice. That's what it's about. I got a few comments I'd like to make, but you have large packets from last year, and there is one thing that happened since you last met. And that is that the Friedman Foundation funded a survey in Alaska to see what Alaskans thought of school choice. And there was one question, I mean, it was really strong. The people of Alaska really strongly approved of school choice. There was one question in particular that really interested me, because it asked, if we took the money, are you for a school voucher program that would pay for private and religious schools? Taking the money away from the BSA, I'm rewording, you can check it out. It takes the money away from the public school and puts it into the private schools. And even though it was worded that way, there were 64% of the respondents, and it was a credible study, said yes, they would approve of that. And the reason I point that one out is both to let you know that that survey happened, but also to let you know that that really isn't what the bill does. You know, the bill sets up a separate appropriations for a school's choice program, and it is not, you know, taking money out of the BSA and putting it toward private schools. So this is a continuation.
Excuse me. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a CS offered, and I'm unfamiliar with the – can we have the sponsor of the CS proceed with the comparison of what the changes are in the current CS that's before us.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I surely intend to get there, but I would like to make a few statements first that will just take a few minutes, and then I'll go through and give you the very general things that I see that are different over the last version that you had in front of you, and there's a specific side-by-side also, I believe, in your packet. So if it's okay, I only have just a little bit more that I'd like to proceed on. I just wanted to, in just a couple sentences, you know, this is about school choice. It's about enhancing school choice in the state of Alaska. That's what this is all about. And it extends the choice from, we already have it in the public schools. A parent can select between one school and another within a district, depending on the availability of room and space for the child, and it's complete there. Because Alaska has a Blaine Amendment, this has not been incorporated the private schools, and that's what this bill does, is it just makes school choice available in the private school realm. It emphasizes, like I say, it emphasizes choice, but I also wanted to say real quickly that it's very consistent with our legislative duties, you know, to get the best bang for the buck that goes out there, public money. And we use private services in every arena, whether we're talking transportation, health, construction, even some aspects of education. So, you know, this just expands to the area to the actual school choice. The CS in front of you is really, the reason I wanted to make those comments first is I wanted to say that the CS in front of you has not changed in any way the point, the policy change that is ahead of this committee, and that is, should we have change, it extends to the private and religious schools. But the differences are, the changes between this version and the last version that was in front of you, one is a big one. Instead of the districts administering these programs, this new version Y now leaves the department EED as the one that administers the program for participating schools in the state of Alaska. You'll see that reflected in the title of Y. You'll also see it on page 1, line 11, if you want to glance at it, but it's throughout the bill because it is a significant change. It no longer puts the district in a position of having to administer this program. Instead, it's the department. Second change, and I don't mind, Mr. Chair, if anyone wants to ask a question. I may have been a little bit blunt, and I don't mean to. I apologize for that. But if you have one to interrupt and ask, as I go on these points, I don't mind. So,
Oh, excuse me, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know what? It's been a year since we've visited this, and I really kind of would like him to go through the whole thing so that we make sure that we remember what everything was. So if you could go down through it and kind of go what it does, and then if there's a change in this version, tell us what that change is. Is that all right?
I will do that. Is it okay with your indulgence, through the chair, Representative Wilson, with your indulgence, could I just give the outline, and then I will go through section by section. If I do it in that order, would it be okay? Because I think if I can give you the four or five things that I see that are significant changes, it'll help us understand as we go through the various sections, if that's an okay approach.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
I believe we all need a refresher, so don't be afraid you're repeating yourself. It was a few months ago.
Okay, great. Thanks. The second thing that is a big change over the one you heard last year is that it just deals with private schools. Last year we tried to make participating schools public schools also, and we ran into so many problems, and so there was so much confusion that we just said, wait, forget it. This is we're going to have just a program here that is available for private and private schools, private religious schools. Third thing is that there's really no difference in the amount of the scholarship than there was in the last program. It's the actual cost of the education, the tuition for the student in the private school with a cap of what a similarly situated student would be eligible for. That's still the same in this bill. We'll go through the section by section, and if you have questions on that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Just to clarify your statement there, you said that last year's bill applied more broadly, and this year just applies to private religious schools?
That's right.
don't understand.
Private entity. I mean, all private schools aren't religious. But yeah, if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Chuck up. He is staff for Senator Dyson, and he has been working on the bill. I gave you that funny blank look because I realized I didn't even identify myself for the record. This is Representative Wes Keller, District 4, Wasilla, and we're talking about HB 145. I apologize to the recorder, who I know is way ahead of us anyway, from my experiences as the chair, and I apologize to the committee. But is that okay if Chuck joins me?
Chuck, please identify yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Yes, sir. Chairman, thank you. My name is Chuck Kopp. I'm staff to Senator Dyson in carrying the companion bill on the Senate side. Thank you.
Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
So, Mr. Chairman, I was just wanting a clarification because the statement that was made was private religious schools, and I thought it was private or religious schools, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what we're talking about.
Oh, thank you for that question, clarifying. That was a misstatement on our part. And or. I mean, this is a response to the Blaine Amendment, which is we have in our Constitution. It says that very clear. It says we can't write checks to a private education institution. And I want to point out, I was getting there in just a little bit, but this is a companion bill to HGR 16, which is already in House Finance, and the passage of this bill is contingent upon the passage of that resolution. And again, that was not a change. That is the same as last year.
Okay. Chuck, did you want to continue?
Representative Seaton is right. This is for the benefit of private or religious schools. There's a number of private schools that are not religious, but it would allow money that right now is prohibited, as Representative Keller says. The Constitution says it cannot go for the direct benefit of a private or religious institution. And this bill, assuming that HGR 16 passes, would allow that to happen. And also, in the first part of the bill there, it establishes the one reason why we went just to private and or religious is because in public schools you already have choice. You can already choose a charter. You can already choose a school as long as there's space available. But you can choose a public statewide correspondence. There is a number of choice opportunities there, and the recognition that the choice we're trying to extend this to is to the private sector. Thank you.
Representative Pruitt?
Sorry, Rep. Seaton, did you want to follow up on?
If I could.
I'll let him follow up.
I guess I'm trying to figure out then, are we cutting out associations of homeschools? Are we cutting, what does this not apply to now that the previous bill applied to?
to the chair, Representative Seaton, it doesn't qualify any more than it did before. It just takes out the fact that a participating school could be a public school. And if a private school is very well defined in statute, as is their accountability to the state. And we have not included anything new in this bill. We have simply taken out the possibility of a public school being a participating school.
Okay. And for the record, Representative Sisson has joined us. Thank you. Okay. Representative Pruitt, then Representative Pyden.
Thank you, Representative Keller. Well, you mentioned something there. I think it was referring to the third paragraph on the revisions there, I think is what you were referring to. Anyways, the cost of how much we would basically be paying. And one of the things I just want to make sure that I understand, is there a mechanism on there? Because obviously we have a lot of discussion on what takes place in the cost in the public schools, how maybe there's we see an increase each year based on different factors, and of course that becomes something that we discuss very robustly down here. What prevents then a private school that really, one of the things that they do is they do a great job of trying to keep their costs down so that their students can afford it. What prevents them now that the state is going to step in and put some money into it from allowing the costs to slowly inch their way up, maybe not, you know, intentionally or with the bad it will, but just they slowly start to increase at a rate higher than they might have previous. Is there a mechanism that we'll have within the Department of Education to ensure that there's, you know, reasonable growth so that the costs for us then in turn aren't growing at a very gradual rate?
Sure. If I could, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's a really good question, and it's one that comes up regularly on the bill. And there's two things I'd like to point to. One is, if you look at the bill, the Yankee, where it talks about that, is we'll go through it in the section by section. I'll find it more. But it's there's a requirement that the private school certifies the actual cost, has been for, the educating of the student. And there's a requirement that it has to go for the education of the student. But more importantly, this is something that's really important. We do not leave that to the department. We retain that in the legislature because this whole bill is subject to an appropriation for this program. And it's highly unlikely, in fact, I'm almost certain that we won't fully fund this thing at the beginning. It won't happen. You know, it'll start out small, and we'll go into this. And what that'll do is it prevents then an entire private school, from assuming it can, all of their students will just automatically, be in effect. So there, as any other business, they are looking for students. So they are to raise the tuition based on the fact that they're going to have some number of scholarships, is unlikely to begin with. But we retain the ability to have the throttle as far as how many scholarships there are, because we can put in more or less money into this appropriation.
So to follow up on that then, how would the pool of money that we appropriate be given to the individual schools? Would it be on a percentage of total cost basis? Would it be, are there determinants in there? And then secondarily to that, is there anything that limits the school that we give it to? Say they can't have all of the funding go to pay for all of the students. Are they then able to choose, okay, then we'll offer an actual scholarship where, 50% of the students can have it paid for and the rest pay, or we have to spread it evenly amongst all the schools? Is there anything that that just leaves that in their hands, or are we somehow controlling how that's distributed within the school as well?
To the chair, Representative Pruitt, the statute that you have before you that you're considering, Yankee, simply says that if there isn't enough to cover everybody, then it's prorated, between the participating schools. Now, as far as what that means, whether that will pay for partial scholarships or this is the second half of your question, or full scholarships or how that works, that's going to be up to the regulation and the process of growth in this program. There's nothing in the bill that specifically lays down those guidelines.
Department of Education would make some of the determinants based on regulations they can potentially write out of this.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Feige?
Can I, on that point?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify. I thought that the department was not going to be able to regulate these schools, and now you're saying that they can determine whether they're going to give partial scholarships to some or full scholarships or not, and it seems like that's getting into writing the regulations for the schools, and I thought the intent was to give them just an amount of money based on their student attendance instead of regulating how they're doing things.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, thank you for the question. It gives me a chance to clarify that one a little bit. The department will have complete power to regulate this program in the context of this law. Okay, so when there's something in there like a prorated amount of scholarships going out that are prorated, then the department has the power to set the standards for exactly how that works. Because that's within the context of this law. This law is written And in the law, it specifically says that it does not imply powers that EED or the district has over the private school that are not covered, when that's what you would expect. But in the context of existing law plus Yankee now, of course, the department will have the power to regulate.
Representative Feige, did you have something earlier?
I think it's been superseded, Mr. Chairman, but if I may add, I'm not so sure we should be even worrying about kind of what you're talking about here. We make the funding available. There's no, we're not spending any more or any less overall on education. It's just we're allowing the market, the competitive market, to decide where that money ends up. And quite frankly, I think we should let the market decide on this one without trying to overmanage the where that money's going.
Representative Sisner, then Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I did not, and I apologize for not having gotten here, but was actually getting caught up on something that I sat down and found out had changed. So I have some real problems with the fact that in our state, we were, when I started this whole game almost a couple decades ago watching all of this, we've had real serious problems. We've had suits against the state in terms of the kind of education that we've been providing for some of our population. And when we talk about the market, we're talking about many different kinds of markets and different kinds of communities that aren't going to be working under the same kinds of rules. Different kinds of education that are really required, and I think we've discussed this in this community about how do we make it reasonable to give an education to different parts of the state that have different markets that they're in and need different kinds of education. So we're dealing with those things, and I've never had a feeling that I had enough of an understanding of exactly what the state does economically and how it gets parceled out and how that fits with what we've been working under, which is No Child Left Behind. How does this program benefit? I can maybe see in Anchorage, I could see something like this working, because we have so many different, got a variety of different kinds of schools. It's a wealth of different kinds of school. But then we have small communities spread vast distances. How does this fit in that?
Representative Keller?
Thank you, Representative Sisna. I see it as a huge advantage. There's a McDowell report that was outside of Anchorage in particular. There's a McDowell report that was very old, but it just examined the rural Alaskans as far as their commitment to wanting their children to have a competitive education. I'll never forget it because it was very specific. You know, there was like 80-some% that really wanted the very best public education so that the rural children could compete with the urban. And I think, it's a policy choice that's in front of you as far as whether or not this will help the rural districts, but I certainly believe the competition will help the schools brush up. And I'd remind you of the studies that you have that I gave out last year. But if I could, because it addresses particularly how vouchers like they're in place in Milwaukee, Florida, in various places, and how it has affected other schools, and it's real positive results in those studies. But if I could, Representative Sisna, before we get too far adrift, I'd like to finish. There's two more things I would like to point out of the difference between this version and the previous version that you had in front of you. And then Representative Wilson has asked that I go through the whole bill, and I think maybe that will be answered better as we go along. And as far as being a little late, you didn't miss much. You just missed the sponsor stumbling around getting used to being in the hot seat again. But thanks.
Okay. Okay, Representative Wilson, are you okay with letting him finish and then get back with your questions?
Yeah. Let me do a little quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
And are we going to have, after the sponsor of this bill, are we going to be hearing from the department and maybe some experts on how the various school systems that we've got across the state would be affected by this and the department on just exactly what our budget is and how this would fit within it?
Thank you. The answer to that is we have people signed up to testify, and we'll hear. We will hear from everybody that signed up to testify.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Feige.
Just a quick thing, and not even really a question for the sponsor, but one of the things about the competitive nature of this is you're not only are you providing additional choices for the students, but you're providing additional motivation for the existing public schools to be more competitive, or they face a loss of students, a loss of budgets, and everything else. So by allowing more competition, you kind of tighten up the whole system. You, in theory, make it more efficient. I think that's where the end result of this will result in better schools all the way around.
Representative Keller, why don't you go and finish, and then we will chime in.
Okay, great. The next thing I'd like to point out is that there has been really good feedback from the committee, and one of the things we have incorporated in the bill, you'll see down in page 3, line 4, is the 10-student dilemma. We have so many small schools in the state of Alaska, and some of them are right on the edge, of having 10 students. And if they don't have 10, they're no longer qualified to be a school. So what we did is we put a ramp there so that the first couple of years, there'd be time, for these schools to respond. And that was at the request of this committee. And lastly, even though it was understood last year, we added the contingency language related to the constitutional amendment, and that's on page 4, line 17. That's the primary changes, Again, from EED to the district, or, I mean, from the other way around, from the district administration to EED, we have taken out the public schools as being participating schools. And then there was a couple of things I just want to emphasize that there were no change on. Then we included this protection for the very small school, and it adds the contingency language. Now, Mr. Chair, do you want me to proceed and go through section by section on what the bill does?
Yes. Well, we had Representative Wilson and Feige. Did you have any further comment before we won?
Well, I've got, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have several things that I am concerned about. One is I'd like to know how many private schools there are in the state and how many religious schools there are in the state so we have an idea of what we're dealing with. Number two, I would like to know what the AG is thinking, or the Department of Law at least, is looking at when we are treating with state money, where, most state money that we give out, we control a little bit of how that money is spent. And there is no control over state money whatsoever here. So I have a little problem over that. And I don't think in this instance we can compare Alaska with any other state. And the reason is there is no other state that their rural areas are as far away as ours are. And many of there's a lot of things in those rural areas that this is not going to help in any way, because you still have to have the kids come to school in order to learn. And I don't think the options in many of those areas, and then I'm thinking of small villages, for an alternative school to take place. I don't think they're even there. So it'd be kind of nice to know not only where those private schools are, or how many there are, but where they're at, so that we can have an idea. When you say it's going to really improve things in the rural areas, are there any private schools or religious schools in those rural areas. I'd kind of like to know. And then, so what you're saying, another thing that you're saying is that you've taken care of it where there's only 10 kids in a school and that they're right on the verge, and you take some of them away, you've allowed a couple years for them to fold. Well, how can they work on improving things when they're supposed to be ramping down to disappear? So I think those are legitimate concerns and things that you need to deal with and things to think about before it gets to the next committee. But I'd like to have some of those questions answered today.
Well, I could respond. There was three parts, at least, I'd like to address. One is, when the Friedman study went out, they made a statement that 2.5% of Alaska students are in private schools. It seemed low to me. You know, I thought it would have been higher than that. But that's the only data that I can give you back right now. We'd have to get back with you on the other. On your second point, I do want to respectfully say that there definitely is control over how this money is spent. When you say no control, that's really a stretch. And I want to point out in the bill on page 2, starting at the very bottom there, line 32, it talks about private schools, and it points to the laws that are existing in statute related to private schools. And there's a number of things that private schools are required to do right now in the state of Alaska. One, of course, is the attendance report. Monthly, they have to monthly report, annual report. There's also a requirement to give nationally recognized proficiency tests, and they are required to keep those records for the student, and they also are required, believe it or not, to make those records public if the public school requires their test results to be public. So there's a lot of accountability there that you and I know that doesn't completely satisfy what you meant. You know, and that's the whole point, is to try to free this thing up so that we can have some competition. The last thing, I can't remember what it was that you pointed out, but so there was three things I wanted to respond to, but do you remember what it was?
I mentioned that I would like to know
the number
of schools and where they're at, if there's some kind of a report from Department of Law, the control of the money, and if they want to do it, is not a control as far as I'm concerned, and no control over whether the kids come or go. But anyway, I'm concerned about getting rid of that we're kind of encouraging some of these schools to fold and force them to go to a private school then. Because they will be forced, the rest of them then would be forced to go to the private school if the school has to close. So that's what's happening. We're forcing, in some instances, those schools to close, and they have to go to the private school because there's no other choice for them.
Respectfully, I don't don't agree. But the part about if you're talking specifically about the 10 cutoff factor there, that's certainly the prerogative of the committee to tighten that one up if you like. It was an approach that I thought was reasonable, because if the small school is still getting the funding, you know, for a short time, I would say that there is an opportunity there. But that's your choice.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson. I had the identical concern, and the amendment number 3 might speak to that. So when we get there. Representative Feige, did you have anything else? Okay.
Sir. Okay, going through the bill itself, just a quick review, and with your permission, I mean, I could certainly do it, but I think Chuck would be probably a different voice here, and maybe one that, because he's been really close and intimately related to the bill, working on the bill with me. With your permission, I'll just turn it over to him.
Feel free.
I'll retain my right to say, hey, wait.
Chuck.
Thank you, Chairman. Again, Chuck Kopp, for the record, staff to Senator Dyson. The first section here, 1431-010, Parental Choice Scholarship Program, establishes the program for the purpose of providing public funding for the cost of attending grades kindergarten through 12 at a private school selected by the student's parent or legal guardian. It establishes that the Department of Education will be the administrator of the program under the provisions of this chapter, and expressly states that participation of a school in the program does not confer authority over a school to the department that is not expressly provided for in this title. In other words, the department has all the authority to administer the program as provided in this title, but doesn't reach beyond that. Page 2, Section 1431.020 talks about school selection and scholarship amount. And it says that a private school that is accepted for participation in the state, participation in the program, may receive a scholarship under the program on behalf of the student who attends the school, regardless of the attendance area in which the student resides. You may have a child that lives right across a bordering, if your area is divided by zip code or by district. It's okay if they drive next door, drive across. In fact, in the public arena, we can do that now. You have to ask the principal or the superintendent if they have space available, but that's allowed. Subparagraph there.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And where a student resides, if he goes to a boarding school, if he resides, let's say he resides in a rural community, and he goes in on a weekly basis or whatever to another school, where is that student residing under the terms of your bill?
Well, I think for purposes of this bill, the residence would be where the child considers home to be. In other words, if they're going to Mount Edgecombe in Sitka, and they actually live in along the Tanana River, their home is still their home where they reside. But I don't really see, I can't see how that would play into the bill right now, what you're saying there.
Well, part of the problem is we have a formula for education which grants to a geographic cost differential. So that students in some parts of the state where you are residing, it's very expensive. And so as I read the bill, this would require the state to pay the high expense to the private school if it has high expenses, couldn't be over its tuition, that even though it's going into a area that would not have that same high expense.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Keller, do you want to respond to that? And then Representative Feige.
Okay. The Chair, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Seaton. First of all, I would say that the legislature decides what level to appropriate this program. And secondly, so it's not going to be by a standard per district BSA as we're used to when a program is administrated by each district, but because it's through the Department of Education, we're looking mostly at the state funding, and we're looking at a program that specifically allows for the Department of Education to appropriate funds to participating schools based on the number of applicants to the program. So let's just say, for example, the legislature appropriated $1 million in the first year, and there was 1,000 applicants. Well, the Department of Education knows where these schools are and how many in each school are applying, and they would prorate it or divide proportionally among those participating schools. It could be that parents only get a couple $100 for that whole school year, but for most people in the private sector, that would, that's still a couple $100. So that's how it gets divided up. What you're thinking about is the geographic cost in each area as if the program is being funded by each district individually. Here the money is coming directly from the Department of Education.
But Representative Seaton.
First of all, it says a little further that you're going to fund them similarly situated student to attend, this is line 9, public school in the district in which the student resides. So unless you are doing something very different, if the program's funded, this says that it's for where the student resides, and that's the level of funding they would get. Now, if you're counting on the legislature underfunding the program and prorating it. Prorating it, every student gets the same amount no matter where they live across the state, meaning that those people in rural Alaska, those schools, are going to get a very lower amount of money proportionally to what the cost of education is than those in urban Alaska. So I can see that in urban Alaska, you might fully fund what the private school would need and pay 100%, whereas those in rural Alaska, you're only going to be giving them 20 or 30%. And so I guess the question will become, as if a constitutional matter, we say you're going to pro rata equalize it across everybody in the state. I mean, we've been down that path. That's why we have geographic cost differentials and those things, because we've lost in court on saying that every student gets the same amount of money no matter where they reside. So I hope you'll take a little look at that.
Mr. Chair, through the through the chair, Representative Seaton, the you're mixing up a couple things, you know, that I'd like to clarify. In at least the way I intend and the way I believe the bill is written. In the first place, when you talk about where the student resides, you're talking about how the Department of Education is going to calculate the amount of money that would be eligible for that participating school, the similarly situated thing. We're talking about a cap. We're talking about the very when you presume full funding or like us to discuss this in the terms of full funding, you're expanding it to something that is just it's just highly improbable. It's just not going to happen. We're not going to fund a school choice program in the state of Alaska at 100%. It isn't going to happen. Secondly, when it says that there's a proration here, it's a prorated to the schools. It is not prorated to the student. So and this is something that has to be regulated and determined, I understand, by the Department of Education. But it says in the appropriation part that if there isn't enough funds to go around, you know, that this will be prorated, you know, to the participating schools. There's not anything here in specific that said even it out between the students in the state of Alaska, like you presumed. So it's either or, you know, in this section. It's either what the private school charges in tuition, you know, or the maximum amount. It's a lesser of the two. Well, it doesn't put it out as a cap, but essentially that's what it becomes. You know, I mean, it's just a long shot safeguard.
Follow up.
So your meaning of proration here is that if you have an expensive school, they will get more money per student than the school that charges less tuition. Is that what you're meaning by proration?
No, my desire is that the bill does not get into that level of specificity that you're trying to get me to respond to, because this is a new program. You know, we can't get that level of detail. So I don't know. But as I understand what will happen, there will be some money put in this fund for school choice. And then there'll be negotiations and regulation and discussion, which I'm sure you'll be part of, in the legislature, as far as just exactly how it works. But the way I see it, if it's a prorated amount, it has to be determined. A lot of details have to be determined how that gets spread out. And it is beyond the scope of this bill to do that within the context of statute.
Representative,
one more
follow-up.
Yeah. I mean, this is a place where the legislature, we don't get into regulations. We don't do the regulations. We do the bill that says what we're going to do with our money. And if we don't know whether proration means that we're going to fund some schools at a higher level because they have higher tuition, or we're going to prorate it because of the number of students, I mean, it means that we're putting forward a bill that we don't know how, a funding bill that we don't know how we're going to distribute the funds. And so I guess I would like to see, before this goes forward, some defining of at least what happens with the money, because we're just not there yet.
Okay. Through the chair, let me respond. would argue that we have nothing to do with regulations. You know, I would say that's not true. When the regulations get written, we get notified. There's public notice of it, and we're specifically notified, and we have the responsibility to be involved in that process. And there's nothing in the bill that talks about the cost, you know, of the participating school. It's just saying that if there's a an amount of money that is shy of 100%, which is almost a given that it will be, then it will be prorated to the various schools.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. Mm-hmm. First one is just to clarify, when you're talking about that the legislature will fund this program or not, this bill really, it's not so much of that he gets funded every year. It's that you're determining, you're taking the total aid package and determining how it gets dispersed, so that the origination of the money is in what the total aid package is for all schools. So not, I don't know that this program would necessarily be financially threatened every year, so much as the, you know, what we'll be deciding is what the overall level of funding is for all the schools in the state. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that's the way I understand it.
Okay, good. Question two. Page two, line four. And it's just, I think maybe it's just semantics, but regardless of the attendance area in the school district in which the student resides, thinking of all the rural attendance areas, rural education attendance areas in the state, should that read or instead of in? Because are you talking about a
attendance area? Right, because some are not school districts.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Does it make sense to you guys that it should be or instead of in?
Rural education districts aren't.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, as I understand your question, yes. I mean, we have unorganized boroughs where your clarification there is valuable.
Okay.
We have Jean Michelle online too for questions related to the amendment. So I would ask the chair if you want to ask her.
Yeah, Jean Michelle, if you're online, would you like to speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jean Michelle. I, with Legal Services, I don't understand the or. Is it after the comma for a school?
Representative Feige.
Okay, it's page two of the bill, line four, regardless of the attendance area in the school district, we should change that one to an or.
I think that reads more clearly.
More clearly as an or?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I make a motion to change that from in to or.
Go ahead. Representative Feige, go ahead and make the motion. Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
Just for clarification, that's going to change the numbering order of all the amendments that you're offering, if that's offered.
So we do that at the end?
Do it at the end. Do it at the end. Thank you. You're good. Okay, streamline. Okay, with that. Let's see, we had Representative Wilson had a comment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I respectfully disagree with the sponsor. On page four, it very clearly says on lines three through eight, it very clearly says that the legislature may or may not appropriate funds to the department for distribution to the participating schools if the appropriation is insufficient, the department shall so that they don't have a choice here. They have to distribute the available funds prorated by the number of students participating in the program. So when they make their regulations, they have to go by what the bill says. And the bill says that they have to do it according to, divide it by the number of students. And so they will make their regulations according to what the bill says, not what you think you want it to be, but what the bill says. And the bill says it will be the number of the participating students prorated by that number.
I am properly chastised, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wilson. The participating school will have a large number of applicants, and they will not. It's not directly. Each applicant will be a representative of a different amount of cap money. Again, keep in mind this is so the proration is to the schools that you left that sentence out. It's not to the but it is based on number of students that apply, but it doesn't specify between what kind of students they are. I mean, there's a lot of people that apply, a lot of students that apply. So the ones that participate in the program may or may not be high cost students compared to low cost students. And I have to point out here that again we're in the weeds a bit, because this is not the intent of the law. Was not to specify how the department would do this. If the committee wants to, of course, that's completely your prerogative. But keep in mind that if you have a student who's quote expensive unquote because of where he or she resides, ultimately we're talking about less money going for the education of that child. I mean, that is a fair statement, because it's based on the cost of educating that student by the participating school. It's not based on, the cap. It's not based on what this child is, quote, worth, crassly, to the school.
Representative Wilson.
Follow up then. Okay, so then you keep talking about the cap. Where in the bill does it talk about the cap? Show that to me so I'll understand it better that way.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. That's a good question, because I guess I anticipated that I was getting in trouble there. But I use that as an example. If you look at the section, page 2, part B, where it says here very clearly that look down on line, start on line 7 there, where it says equal to the lesser of the cost of the tuition of the participating school or the amount the district would receive state and local aid under 14.17 for a similarly situated student to attend a public school in the district in which the student resides. So it's the or there that makes it loosely, and again, maybe Jean has a comment on this, but in my mind, that makes it a cap, because it's based on the lesser of the two. And just logically speaking, the lesser of the two is going to be the tuition costs, unless something happens that, where this was fully funded and all the costs went skyrocketed because there was no restrictions, and that was back to Representative Pruitt's original question.
Representative Cisna?
I have a question that's a little different, in that one of the things that we really have a serious problem in Alaska is the No Child Left Behind, and the fact that we've got situations all over the state where districts children are being left behind big time because of the school district that they're in. And this one actually has an incentive to have the costs lower, or the costs of the school lower, not the product. Product isn't a part of this, which is, that's something you might think about.
through the chair, Representative Fisna, I really appreciate that, because that's what this is about, is the education of the kids. It's not about protecting districts. It's not about protecting legislators. And it's not about protecting EED, you know, and I really thank you for pointing that out, because seriously, it's about choice. You know, it's about should or should not in Alaska parents have the choice to send their children to a private school. It's as simple as that. And you give me an opportunity to repoint that out. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Pruitt, did you have something?
No, I don't.
Okay. Excuse me. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm obviously a lawyer put this particular paragraph together. All it's saying is that if the actual tuition cost charged by the private school happens to be less than the bill, it saves money for the state by paying the lesser amount instead of the overall amount.
I understand.
What's going to happen in the competitive market is that tuition is going to rise to whatever the state funding level is.
Yes.
Right? Okay? So.
That is what will happen.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And, you know, I think to assume that without a cap on funding, I mean, this is going to go to the legislature every year for appropriation. There's going to be a number of scholarships. We know the amount. To assume and not build in a cap, if you want to fund this to 40% or 50% of the BSA, then it needs to say that. You can't assume that the legislature is going to always be underfunding the education of the students of the state, especially if you're saying that you have 65% of the, or 64, whatever that was, people across the state want it. So what the problem on line 8 is that the state would actually be paying more for each one of these students than we do to those going to a district school. And that's because it says that the state is going to pay what the scholarship, that's on line 7, is equal to the lesser of the cost of tuition, which we just acknowledged Representative Feige understands is going to go up at a participant, or the amount the district received from state and local aid. So we are now, the state is going to be paying the local aid at the four mills as well as the state, because when we do state funding, we subtract four mills that are contributed by the local community, and in this case, we are going to be paying, they're going to be keeping that money, their four mills, and in the district, and we are going to be paying not only the normally what we pay is the state aid minus the four mills. Now we would be paying to the private schools that plus the four mills, because this says we're paying the four mills as well as the state aid. So just so everyone's clear that we're actually from state coffers, if we fund the program, and if we don't put constraints on the program, we should better assume that we're going to fund the program. We would be paying more to each one of those students out of state coffers than we are to students in the public.
Representative Keller.
Sure. First of all, I want to say your original comments there. This is, you know, I mean, just keep in mind, this is putting money, government money, in a private market that has never had government money. That's, you know, pretty radical, and there's going to be a process. So, but in response to what you said, I would just respectfully ask the committee to let that one go until we get to education, and I will, to finance, and I commit that, you know, we will get to the bottom of that, you know, as far as how the local contribution fits in. I think we can trust our compadres in finance to be very much aware of that dilemma where we're talking state money, you know, balanced against local money. So, anyway, that's...
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under this instance, I think because we have been serving on the Education Committee, we understand the funding process probably a little bit better than other legislators in our body, just because of the fact that not only do we pay the four meals, you're asking for us to pay the four meals, but we're already doing it every year we pay more of that four meals than we did the year before. We're already doing it now, and I don't think maybe the understanding is there is what we're actually doing. We're actually doing that already. Not the total four meals, but every year that increases to most of the areas across the state except those rural areas that don't have to pay the four meals. And so we're already, the state is already paying more to the schools that have taxing ability than we do to the areas where they don't.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the reason that I made that request, I agree, by the way, that the complexities of the education funding, you know, as we walk through it over and over again, you know, we realize that, you know, this really takes some time to put it all together. The reason I asked to forestall that is that I would rather that piece be in there, because if we start talking about a percentage of, you know, I called it the cap. If we start saying, okay, a percentage of that is what is appropriate for a cap, I would like the local money to be part of that consideration. So just for what if? And I don't really would appreciate it, again, that this gets put off and assuming more testimony and more work, and you know that I'm not going to get by with slipping anything past anybody on this. That is not my intent. But if we take the total state contribution plus the local contribution, you know, and then deal with a percentage of that eliminates the concern about the 4%, you know, that should be part of the consideration. That's the only thing. It is money that is being spent right now for students in the state of Alaska. You know, I mean, we want to get a comparable amount here that's fair, you know, and that's why I wanted to wait, is that if we get into a formula of any kind, I would invite the department to work with us on that and come up with an option. But for now, keep it in there, please, as a placeholder.
That's what I was asking.
You know, but of course, it's a prerogative of this committee, and I don't, you know, I will not be resentful if you make a change.
If there's no other comment, we could move on to public testimony. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Feige.
And we got hung up on all this. Mr. Kopp was going through the bill. If we could have him continue to...
Forgive me, I thought we were done. Go ahead. I felt done.
Briefly, Chair, I will continue. Thank you. Looking at subparagraph C on page 2, the parent or legal guardian shall be responsible for costs and fees assessed by the participating school that exceed the amount paid under this program. So whatever the school charges, it's more. It's up to the parent to pay the difference. The department shall provide transportation to a participating school to the extent that is required under AS 1409020, which talks about the transportation of non-public school students. If you live on a comparable route over a comparable distance, you're already transporting kids back and forth anyway, then a non-public school child may ride. That's it in a nutshell. Line 16, a scholarship received for the benefit of a student under this section must be used for educational purposes, and a scholarship is transferable among participating schools.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
A scholarship is transferable among participating schools. Would you go through several scenarios in which people are trading scholarships or trading students or what they're, how?
I can give you one that comes to mind. Again, the scholarship, the way, and this is, as Representative Keller has said, this may get refined later, but we don't see the scholarship at all being based on the cost of education at a particular school, but based on schools getting scholarships based on the number of applicants they have. So some schools will have more scholarship applications pending just because they have more kids applying to go, and some schools will only have a few. Secondarily to your question, you may have a child, first semester is going to one participating school, and the second semester would like to go, they're already a scholarship program kid, they would like to go to another participating school. if schools have been awarded a scholarship program, scholarship money under the program, this just says that that option is available for them to transfer to another participating school. Now, obviously, there's other administrative factors. There has to be room. They have to be accepted. But the money under the program would allow for that child to transfer to another participating school.
Representative Seaton and Representative Feige.
Yeah, two questions. I don't see in here, and maybe I've just missed it, where we're not talking about scholarships for attendees. We're talking about scholarships allocated for applicants. And some schools might have lots of applicants, and some might have a few applicants, and we're going to award scholarships based on the number of applicants.
We'll get to it in the bill, but each school is required to show the attendance of people under the program to the Department of Education.
But your statement was that the funding would be allocated based on the number of applications.
Well, they have to be accepted by the school to attend, but the school can say that this is pending, each year the legislature has to appropriate funding for the program. You've applied to attend here under this state scholarship program. So if that money comes through, then they would be an attendee then at that point, not an applicant. And they would have to show that through attendance records that are mandatory and are included here in the bill, that you have a child attending under the program, this participating school.
Follow up.
Just to follow up, I guess I'm really confused that we're saying that we're going to forward fund these schools, apparently, based on the number of applications, and that still doesn't come back to the funding based on the school district in which the student resides. That presumes different levels of funding. And yet the student can transfer from one school to another, which may have different levels of funding, but he has, I guess I'm going to need some more clarification, but we can do that in a little bit.
Representative Feige, then Representative Sisna. Feige?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, two things regarding Representative Seaton's applicant terminology. I think applicant is probably the wrong word to use. The person needs to be already accepted at the school, because I can foresee where guy applies to six different schools. Well, the way this is written, six different schools would get that child's benefit equally. Okay, so there has to be, at some point, we have to decide which school the student is attending. Now, the application process can start 2 years prior. I don't care. But whenever that student is enrolled in that school, then the money follows that student, should be the way this thing is set up. The second thing, going back to the paragraph that you were talking about, and I think this is just, again, to clarify what you're trying to do, where you say a scholarship is transferable. So under the current system, we take the student counts in October, and basically that's the funding that the that the school gets for the whole year. What you're saying under this is that if somebody is under one private school, say in October, if that's the date we decide to use as the count, that the money, since we're not allocating the money each month, we're allocating it once a year, essentially. Once that money has been allocated to that private school, if the student transfers, this sentence here is giving permission for whatever the prorated share of the rest of the year is, that money can then go to the next private school if the student changes his attendance. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Feige, that is. And also under department duties, we have stated that the department makes quarterly payments to the school under the program. And so there's a quarterly assessment then that would occur. So there is kind of a stopgap in there, if you will, that and I'm getting ahead of myself in the bill, but under department duties, it says that the department will make scholarship payments directly to the school quarterly after receiving proof satisfactory to the department that the student claimed under a scholarship attends the school on a full-time basis. So that may help.
Okay, represent.
For members of the committee, is that clear? Things
Representative Seaton on that,
thank you.
On that
just,
issue.
Just on the participating schools. So this means that if the student gets a scholarship, I'm participating in a school, private school thing that's allocated to them, but then if they decide to go to a public school, the public school has to educate them, but they get no funding for them because they weren't there in October. Is that, or does this also go back to the money is transferred to the public school as well?
Okay, Representative Seaton, this is money that stays in this scholarship program, which would be for private and or religious schools, so it's not going to transfer out of that program. But the second part of your question is public schools already have a mechanism now for kids coming and going. It happens all the time. I mean, you have to give your account at a certain point during the year and say this is how many we have. But that doesn't prevent you as a principal from accepting a student into your classroom just because they weren't there in your account that you submitted in October. That happens. Kids do come and go.
Are you saying they get funding?
Excuse me?
Oh, sorry.
What I'm saying is in the state BSA, that's assumed that happens, that kids come and go. Now, so I don't want to mix up what happens in the public sector. In the private sector, this program just says that a scholarship is transferable among participating schools.
Excuse me, Representative Keller.
Yeah, just another clarification on this. When we're talking about students that obviously are going to change from school to school, keep in mind on page 3 down there, this is again getting ahead a little bit, but on line 17 that the department is supposed to, provide a list of participating schools to the parents, so that, it's presumed that they have the choice to.
I'd like to add, too, you might remember in the beginning of this meeting, I said there's a couple issues I'd like to talk about. One of them is the count date, because that same phenomenon happens in within the public schools themselves all the time. Somebody will, show up in November and they have to teach them throughout the whole year. It's a problem that we really do need to speak to this year. Representative Sisson, we've been ignoring you for quite a while.
Okay. Well, and I certainly am not feeling like that at all. This is an ongoing discussion, and it's been very rich. And I think there's questions, I'm hearing questions that I think we're all needing to get answered because there's a number of details here. My understanding is, unless something's changed radically, that there is a count date, and I thought it was maybe in November or October, it's October, and if students are in their seat on that date, then the school, that counts for that school. And if they're not, they come the day afterwards or the day after that, school doesn't count them, or it's not at the state level seen as a student, but it's a cost. And the school has to cover that cost no matter what, because it's a public school. And it's not a matter of their accepting people. And then that's my other question, is the acceptance of the applicant. And I know in your previous bill you had designations of the kinds of criteria that were involved in acceptance, and they fit a lot of what I see in the public school system in terms of acceptance. I think it's really important to have an idea of what that is, if in fact what we have in many communities, for instance, a high population of students that have special needs. And when you got a very large population of your school district that has special needs, then you have much higher costs, and it's much tougher for everyone. It would be very convenient to be able to have a school alongside of that school that's operating in a separate under separate rules, and all of a sudden no one, you were able to select how many disadvantaged people you have in your school. I have a number of constituents that actually have real concerns about that in my own school district, and so that's something I'm going to want to have an understanding of, is what kind of, it's not public school, but does that mean the public doesn't have a fair chance?
Do you want to respond to that before we move on?
It's a very good question, and, you know, food for thought, and I thank you, but rather I would really humbly request that we continue with the sectional analysis because of the time crunch, and you know, let that discussion happen, you know, as we go. You know, because it's really a fun question to consider. A similarly situated student, is that student a special ed student or not? You know, and that discussion again is going to be relegated to the process of understanding. I actually anticipated that situation where maybe there would be some help from the private sector on intensive needs students, you know, and of course there you really see a glaring difference, you know, between Title 14 and you know, the tuition of any school that I know of. No school that does that. But, I mean, it just opens up some options. That's part of the, that's the reason for the bill.
Representative Sisson.
One other area, and there's it's probably almost a yes or no answer, and that's in this bill, I don't see the potential of school districts or boroughs being able to opt out of this. Is this uniform across the state, or is it possible to think about having test cases in opening it, and think about the opt-in, opt-out?
That's not a yes or no question. It is worth a discussion, and I think it might be partly answered if we continue on.
Okay, Representative Pruitt, did you have a comment here?
Yeah, I just had one question, just due to the time, and is it possible that we might be able to allow them to go through the whole thing and just hold any questions till just after they're completely
Great.
Through?
Let's do.
Thank you, Chair. Page 2, Section 1431.025 talks about accountability and enrollment standards for a participating school. It says the department will accept a school for participation in the program if the school submits to the department on a form that's approved by the department notice that the school intends to participate in the program. It meets the following financial accountability standards. School must demonstrate its ability to repay to the department any overpaid scholarship funds. School must certify the actual annual cost to the school of educating a student, including a prorated amount for facility and operating costs, and is a school that is a private correspondence study program located and operated entirely in the state, or a private school operated in compliance with AS 1445-030, which are your non-exempt private schools required to abide by all the laws that we currently have for public education, or exempt schools under 1445-100 through 130. And again, those are the requirements for schools that say they're exempt because according to statute, they do nationally standardized tests in 4th, 6th, and 8th grade. They keep their vaccination records. They do the mandatory enrollment reporting to the superintendent of the school district. There's two or three things, and I believe the committee has the notes on what exactly are those that are required. But schools that choose to follow that then are exempt from other laws that have to deal with the Department of Education. Section 1431.030, effect on districts. This one we appreciate from the chair. Notwithstanding the lower limit for a student count of 10, under AS 1417-450, that's public money based on your school. The minimum school size for public funding is 10. This says that a school as a result of this program has an average daily membership of less than 10 shall be treated as if the school had 10 students for a two-year period following the date on which the ADM is reported to be less than 10. So if that reporting period is in October, they would have 2 days beyond that date of full funding.
So following that date, for purposes of calculating the school size factor. Under departmental duties, the next section, in implementing this program, the department will obtain from the participating school a count of the number of participating students in the program. We'll make scholarship payments quarterly to the participating school after receiving satisfactory proof to the department that the child has attended school on a full-time basis. The department will make available to students and students' parents or guardians a list of participating schools that have been accepted to participate in the program and provide a standard application for use by the schools to enroll a student under the program. It does allow the schools to supplement the application based on the specific nature of each private school involved. Finally, if the department determines that a school is ineligible under this chapter to participate in the program, it requires that the department will immediately notify affected students and the students' parents or guardians after administrative and judicial appeal period have lapsed. Next, under regulations, it says the department will adopt regulations necessary to carry out the program that ensures the highest number of participation, student and school participation in this program. This will include procedures for calculating and distributing scholarships, timelines and procedures for application, renewal, and appeal for participating schools and students, and standards for acceptance, revocation, and denial for participating schools. Under appropriations for scholarships, it states that the legislature may appropriate parental choice program funds to the department for distribution to the participating schools. If the appropriation for the program is insufficient in a given fiscal year, the department will distribute the available funds to the schools prorated by the total number of students participating in the program. And definitions are given of what district means, private school. These are identified in statute already. Program is identified as the parental choice scholarship program, and a student is already identified, someone who's at least 5 years of age, but not more than 21, and then the contingency language. That's a brief run through.
Uh-huh. Representative Feige.
Going back to page 3, line 12. That's, I'll call that subparagraph 1, but in subparagraph 2, immediately below it, you're making payments quarterly, but I don't see where it says you obtain a count, but is that going to be a quarterly count or an annual count? I think we should specify when that count is going to be and what we're going to base our funding to the private school on. It just seems to me to be a little vague. Could you address that?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, thank you for that question. In my plain reading of it, you're right, it is a little bit vague, but it appears that the payment can only be made unless they have shown that the child has attended on a full-time basis that quarter. So, I mean, when you read that, the proof satisfactory to the department is that the child was here for the full quarter. Then they get their quarterly payment.
Okay, so then they'll have to obtain a participating count quarterly.
Quarterly, yes, sir. That's the plain reading.
I think we should put that in the statute.
Okay. Okay.
And we'll probably maybe save that for my
save it.
Yeah.
And I would ask the question, are they making the payment quarterly? Is that quarterly of the school year or that's quarterly of the calendar year? I would assume it would be of the school year.
Schools go on the quarters. Yeah, quarterly. So the school year, yeah.
And then just a follow-up.
Representative Feige and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, this seems to be creating a lot of confusion in everybody's mind, but lines 3 through 8, that particular paragraph, what we're appropriating at the legislative level is the overall funding amount that goes out in AS 14.17. And that money may fluctuate other by itself for everybody. And since this bill essentially establishes a formula based on that level of funding to pass money through to private schools based on their attendance of students, I'm not sure, do we even need this whole section? Is there a reason for why this has to be anything? Because I think it adds a lot of confusion, and we're not really, the money is what the money is going to be, and there's risk on the part of the private school, because they don't know what the funding is going to be, much like our public schools. And that's one of the major complaints that the public schools have. So that's a risk that funding levels will change, and you know, certainly student levels are going to change. But if we start trying to screw with things too much by introducing this whole pro rata thing, I just think it makes the overall program less clear. And I
Representative
everybody else's opinion, but why do we even need that paragraph?
Representative Feige, through the chair, you're proposing just striking the last sentence of that. Not the, you said section, I think, but you meant the sentence starting on page 5, or line 5 there.
Well, I think we're already appropriating, we're appropriating money for education as a whole already. We're not really trying to appropriate money for a parental choice scholarship program. The scholarship program is embedded in where that appropriated money goes to already in the bill here. We've already decided where that, how that money is going to be spent. It's going to be up to the competitive nature of the market, really.
Sure.
Chris, do you want to respond to that?
No.
Okay, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, on that.
Sorry.
On that.
Excuse
point,
me, Representative Feige, finish your thought.
On that point, what I believe is set out here is not in the current funding for schools. This is a totally separate program, a totally separate appropriation. It just takes the level of funding that we use for the school systems and would allocate that out of this new appropriation that's in addition to the appropriation we make to education. And if we put enough money into that, then it would kind of equivalent, well, it would be actually higher, but it would be kind of equivalent with the funding we give to public schools. But if we didn't put as much into it, this separate appropriation, there wouldn't be as much money as we give to public schools, but it's totally separate from the money we give to public schools, as I understand the intent of the bill and the wordings here, is this is a separate appropriation, separate allocation for a separate scholarship program. It's not our normal base student allocation. It's just based upon the same amount of money, whatever the base student allocation and local local aid calculation is, and I'd like clarification, if that's correct.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton and Representative Feige, just to encapsulate the whole question, when the legislature makes an appropriation amount available, we don't know what the tuition cost is going to be for the private schools. There's no way we're going to be able to come up with something and no change to actually say, okay, the legislature is appropriating 341 private school scholarships this year. It's an amount of money. And then the development of the regulations and the process to put that in place, it has to grow. We cannot at this end, you know, anticipate all the things that are going to come up in this and define every detail of it. I see it as a protection, not a confusion. I see it as a protection is that as this grows, you know, we will have right regulations and change laws to make it better.
Follow up, Representative Feige.
Okay, perhaps I'm misunderstanding this, but we're taking overall the numbers of students statewide. We don't know until we count them in October what they're going to be. Okay, so all we're doing is we're saying that as
as students opt to leave the public school system to the private school system, we're saying that money that we've already appropriated for the public school system, is the department is going to essentially debit the public schools and credit the private schools.
Not in my mind, Representative. The way I am understanding it, did you have a comment? Good first shot.
Sure. That's one way of looking at it, but we want the program to be open to students that are currently attending private school. There will certainly, during the application period, whatever period that is, the Department of Education would be able to come and say, we had 319 applications from current public school students, and you're right, Representative Feige, in those sense, there is no new money, because they would just be lowering on one hand over here, raising over here, and saying they've applied to enter the program, and the legislature would know, okay, we're at least going to be 319 down if we fully fund. In that sense, it's the same money, just following the kid. But you may have people that have not been in the public school system but currently attending private that apply for the program. And that would be money that the state has never had to fund before, that parents have assumed all that responsibility for.
Okay, and for the, if I may, Mr. Chairman, so for the first year, you're going to see a bump in the overall level of funding. But then once you get all the students in the state of Alaska into the pool, are we going to be then appropriating money for all the students in the state of Alaska, or are we going to be appropriating two separate pots? I think if we go with two separate pots, if I'm the entrepreneur that's going to set up a private school, there's a huge risk that I'll make an investment that the legislature will, private school, we're just going to delete you guys from the system and not fund the program. That's a huge risk that will be a major impediment to having this whole program go forward. So to set up two separate appropriations, I understand what you're saying by, okay, now we're going to take and add sort of the private school guys to the pot. But once that pot becomes defined as all the students in the state of Alaska, and we're going to fund all those students in the state of Alaska, it all needs to be funded as one appropriation, and then the department can figure out how to allocate the monies. Otherwise, that's a major hindrance to somebody, to anybody making investments that will improve our school system.
Representative Wilson, I'm not going to forget you, but I think Representative Pruin wanted to speak to that first.
No, I think Chuck actually kind of answered part of that, but I will respond to kind of how I view this. This is completely separate, and it would be appropriated quite in a completely separate manner, which is why I think the line 5 through 8 here is required, because we may choose to appropriate at different levels. And you have hit on something that I think is important to notice. There could be someone that could set up a school, and we might not appropriate, and they might not have the money. Same thing, a family could start sending their kid to a school, and the next year find, if we don't appropriate it, that they may have to pull more out of their pocket. So there are things to consider that this could potentially, we almost have to be ready to fund it at a certain level on a continual basis, and we have to be ready to do that. And please, Wes Keller, or Representative Keller, if you'd please speak.
I tell you what I'd like to do. If you could respond to that, we get Representative Wilson make a comment, and then we have some folks online that have been hanging for a couple hours here. So I'd like to give them time to testify, and then we're not going to wrap this up, put a bow on this today. So if we could do it in that order.
Thank you, Representative Feige and Representative Pruitt. I actually prefer what Representative Feige is presenting. I mean, I think Representative Pruitt acknowledged that too. I think that the way we have proposed it in this bill, making a separate appropriation, it does several things. One is it gives us something we can put our hands around and define to say, okay, we got a big policy switch coming here. We're going to put some money into the private sector that's never had it before, and it leaves the protections there. And that's exactly why local or your private schools won't raise their tuition. I mean, it actually makes a protection there that it's exactly why we're not going to see them go right up to the cap. I mean, that concern is taken away by the fact that we are making it a separate appropriation for now. But, you know, it explores an area.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
One thing that I think that we need to, I don't know what to do about this, but public schools, most of them are set up with unions. And so if you have a special ed child in that classroom that requires an aide, because we have, I think it's 17 times the amount normal, so that we can pay for that. Okay, that is a contract. That aide is into that classroom by a contract. And if, say, second semester, that student goes somewhere else, well, this public school has already signed a contract for that aide. They've lost that student. They don't need the aide, but they have to pay the aide for the whole rest of the year because of that. Now, a public school or a private school, I don't even know how they do it, but if they're not in a union, they can say to this aide, well, the student moved, and so we don't need you, bye. I mean, I don't know how they do it, but they could do it that way, I'm guessing. I don't even know. But how are we going to deal with those situations where when there's a transfer, the money follows it, but the school needs the money because they had a contract? Now, that's just something that's up in the air, and if that can change every quarter, which we don't do now, how are we going to deal with that?
Just a real quick response. I think there's a lot of what ifs like that are not answered, and that's again because it's a new area. I know of no private intensive needs schools, so the scenario you present is one that is really far off. If there is one, I'm unaware of it. The intensive needs students right now are in the public schools, I understand.
Go ahead, follow up.
So what we're doing then is this is discriminating against special ed kids because they can't go to another school where other kids can.
No, I have to be able to respond to that. No, not at all. It doesn't exclude them at all. But I'm just saying there's no school out there. You know, that's so the only thing. There's no private school out there.
It allows, it opens up the possibility that there's
students. Excuse me, wait. Let's, I don't want to be controlling here, but we can't have a free-for-all. Representative Feige.
Thank you. I think it opens up the possibility that special ed schools could be established if someone wants to come in and provide the service, and it enables the money to be made available to help do that.
Excuse me, Mr.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Feige. Representative Seaton, go ahead.
We have a lot of schools in this state that aren't special education schools, but if they have a student that's a special education student, they have to deal with it the best they can. Why wouldn't these private schools have to do the same thing?
Representative Seaton.
Representative Wilson, I think the answer is that this bill is specifically designed to let the schools pick and choose the people that will go, whether it's on religious grounds. You could have a Catholic school, you could have a Jewish school, you could have a Muslim school. All of those will qualify under this on religious grounds, and they can exclude people that do not wish that. And this is also on if they're special ed kids and you don't want them, you can reject them on those grounds. That's what the purpose of this following the constitutional amendment is to overcome, is so that the individual private or religious school can adopt its own standards. It doesn't have to follow, if the constitutional amendment passes, it doesn't have to follow the current ability of individuals to attend a school of their choice.
Representative Pruitt?
I think the situation that Representative Wilson brings up is a little different than allowing whoever you want within the school. I think, if I understand it correctly, that the school would have to be able to have that program in place, because, and I don't think we, I don't know that we'd be we're not requiring them to have, because that's a little different than a situation that, like we talked about, what are they going to teach as per se the religious? That's a little different because it really is an additional cost, as opposed to we'd almost be telling them, and that would be something we'd have to, it would be an additional policy change here, that we'd have to tell them that they have to establish above and beyond what they currently are, the certain qualifications to be able to handle those students. I don't think it's a discriminatory thing as much as it's an additional cost, and not all of the schools would be able to afford that. With if they had one or two students coming to their school, then and we gave them the money, I still don't know that they'd be able to afford it. It's a different.
We're expecting.
It's a different. I understand where you're coming from, and it's not a. It's. I just don't think that the schools are set up to do that. That would be somewhere we could go, but I think we'd have to put that into this bill here. We'd have to decide to put that policy change in there. I just don't think that's where it's going at this point, and that's a significant additional cost factor. Chuck may have something to.
Excuse me. How about Representative Feige? Then I'd like to hear from the two people online. This is obviously not going to wrap up today.
Right.
Okay, so let's Representative Feige. Then let's hear from the two folks online, and I bet we're going to run out of time. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To address Representative Wilson's question, obviously the private school may or may not offer the services for that special needs person. We have already mandated that the public school must provide the services if a student attends there. I think addressing the funding, say somebody signs a contract for that school year to provide special needs services, that money is going to be there for that entire year, whether or not if in November the student leaves. Okay. Therefore, the money may not be there for the private school, which I don't expect the private school would offer the service if the money was not going to be there. So I think, in the end, the special needs students will be served one way or the other. And I think the financial remuneration to the special ed teacher will be covered, at least for the period of their contract. So. I'm not sure that this is
okay. I appreciate the enthusiasm here, but through the chair isn't just an expression. It really does mean we can't have a verbal free for all, right? Okay. So I promise everybody will get their turn and all, but we really do need to have a order here.
Can the sponsor respond? Because I think he's been itching to respond to that thing. We've been responding, and
no, I realize that we're not going to get done. I just want
we're not going to get done.
Sincerely say thank you to the committee for again, working through the issues. It's a big policy change, and I also want to put on the record that I really appreciate the help and the assistance I've gotten from the other body. Mm-hmm. And the other body staff, obviously, I think it's become real obvious that he probably understands as much or more about the bill than I do. And there's been coalition meetings all summer, and he's been engaged. So just thank you is all I'm trying to say.
Excuse me. Okay, I'd like to open for public testimony. We have two people online, Tom Fink and Jeffrey Mittman. Tom, are you still there? And if so, please identify yourself and who you represent and give us your testimony.
Yeah, I'm still here. Tom Fink, testifying as an individual and as a member of the Educational Task Force. I'm really not totally able to testify to this bill because I haven't seen it before. The last draft I saw was January the 10th, which I was ready to fully endorse. The big change is apparently has been made is cutting the local districts out. The concept of the legislation was that a child who went to a private school would get the same financial support as a child that went to the public school. And that included local government participating in the draft of January 10. That does create some problems. I do agree with Representative Feige on the concept of the appropriations. It ought to be part of the overall education appropriation. But I do hope that you finalize some committee substitute and move it out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions of Tom Fink? Okay, lacking any further question, Jeffrey Mittman, are you there? And if so, please identify yourself, who you represent, and give your testimony.
I am, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska, and I thank the Chair for the opportunity to testify on this bill. I have previously submitted to the Chair and Vice Chair and the members of the committee some written testimony. As the committee may be aware, the ACLU focuses on constitutional issues, and we focus on rights of Alaskans under the U.S. and Alaska constitutions. While we don't have any expertise with regard to school funding issues and private and public schools, what we do focus on is constitutional rights, and in this case, those related to First Amendment concerns with respect to the Establishment Clause of the U.S. and Alaska constitutions. As drafted and as noted more fully in our written testimony, even were the Blaine Amendment, this specific language in the Alaska Constitution forbidding public funding of religious schools to be deleted, which obviously we believe is not a wise choice, there are further problems with this bill with respect to Establishment Clause issues. Very briefly, because based on our research, it appears that about three-quarters of the private schools in the state of Alaska are religious schools. And because there are lesser regulations and restrictions on discrimination and protections for students by religious private schools, were this to pass and were HJR 16 to pass, there would still be significant problems with the bill and with funding issues. Essentially, what this would do is HB 145, if passed and fully enacted, would begin to entangle the state in religious questions. The ACLU fully supports and would defend religious freedom. For example, if the state of Alaska were to attempt to restrict students' rights to attend religious schools, that is something we would have to fight. We believe it's important that families have the right to choose to send their children to religious schools. However, when you look at public funding of religious schools, that's an entirely different question. The founding fathers of the United States, and I believe of the Constitutional Convention of Alaska as well, understood that it is best and safest for religion that government does not get entangled with it. And entanglement clearly becomes an issue when there is public funding. You then have questions of, can a school continue to proselytize? Can its teachers continue to teach religious doctrine if they're receiving public funds? We believe the answer should be no. So therefore, we would urge the committee to look at the bill and before moving it forward, to take out any language that would involve the state of Alaska in funding of private religious schools in violation of the federal and certainly of the Alaska constitutions. With that, I will again refer to our written testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the one that perhaps I detect a flaw in your argument because, you know, I understand the bit about perhaps the religious school proselytizing and where we want to keep a separation between church and state, but it seems to me that applies to a situation where the public school is the only school available to a particular student, and that to have religious proselytizing in that public school would then somehow infringe upon that student's right to religious freedom. However, if the student has made a conscious choice to go to that religious school, that student also can make the conscious choice to go to another school, back to the public school. So I'm not sure that argument necessarily carries water.
Any other comment?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, thank you for the question. For example, if there were a district where a student chose to go to a private school, but then the school conditioned that student's participation in an educational program on agreeing to a religious tenet, again, were this school purely private and were there no state funding involved, that would not be a problem. That school's absolute right. In this case, however, where the state of Alaska were to choose to open up private religious schools to public funding, can we then say that the school can limit attendance only to those students who agree to abide those religious tenets? And in that case, we are essentially funding that proselytizing or those discriminatory policies. So the problem is that by giving public funding to a private school, you then are in the position of essentially converting, in some respects, that private school into a public school.
Any other comment? Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much. And my question, it's Jeff, is it?
Jeffrey Mittman.
Yeah, Jeffrey. Yes, and hello, Jeffrey, and Sharon Cisna here. And my question is that it sounds as if you've been doing some studying of the different schools, and I haven't heard any comments about the wide distribution we have of population that goes to school around just dissimilar, completely different communities across the state, and how do we actually get education that is critical to those communities, and have a system that actually includes the people that actually live in that area, not exclude certain ones, for instance, those that possibly have handicaps of different kinds. And have you studied the different private schools to the extent of understanding where the, for instance, the different special schools exist that are in the private school sector? Are they distributed across evenly, or are there certain communities where there are larger groups of, say, religious schools?
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, thank you for the question. The data we reviewed is from the National Center for Education Statistics, and that's a part of the U.S. Department of Education, and it's referenced on page 2 of our testimony. At this point, we have not specifically looked at the geographic distribution. That's certainly something we can do, and the question you pose raises an additional issue as to whether or not there would be protections for students with disabilities. As the committee is aware, the Supreme Court of the United States recently ruled just last week that private religious schools are, to a significant extent, exempt from the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it could very well be that through this bill, there could be Alaska state funding of a school that were legally entitled to discriminate on the basis of disabilities.
Okay, with that, I think we're not going to close public testimony, but we will end testimony today.
There's someone that's here. He's here.
So, okay, let me ask the committee. We do have one person here, individual in the room. Is the committee willing to extend the meeting? Okay, great. In which case, Steve Evanson, would you come forward and identify yourself for the record?
My name is Steve Evanson. I'm here this morning representing the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. I also am a pastor here in the local community that does have a private school, and would like to bring you a few statements. While our concern is more a warning to the religious and parochial schools that receive the money, it is good to remind everyone that increasing dependence upon such monies can and often does result in the increasing vulnerability of the religious mission of these schools through state programming regulations such as determining what can and cannot be taught, and during a major financial crunch cause the crippling and shutdown of said schools due to the sweeping withdrawal of such voucher-based financial support. That being said, we are neither for or against this proposal. We are simply offering principles for church institutions to consider when evaluating the acceptability of state financial aid. In dealing with the practical question of when it is appropriate for church schools or institutions in the faith community to accept support or funding from the government, the following principles should be considered. One, would accepting the aid establish a precedent that would undercut the religious freedom protections guaranteed by the First Amendment and the broad principle it embraces, the separation of church and state? Two, Does the aid come attached with conditions or requirements that would inhibit or interfere with the religious mission or goals of the institution, such as the restriction of its religious activities or standards? 3. Is there a reasonable likelihood that the aid would create a dependency by the religious institution on the government benefit program, so much so that it would inhibit its future ability to act independently? In conclusion, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association and its board of directors offer these principles in the form of questions so that meaningful dialogue can occur at all levels of the faith community. In a spirit of helpfulness, we believe that these 3 questions can substantially safeguard the faith community and its institutions from undue compromise and hardship in the future, and thus protect the vitality of its prophetic mission in America. I have brought documents with these 3 principles that are available to the committee.
Thank you. Comments from committee? Representative Seaton.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that we could get those for our records.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Where can I give those?
Excuse me, I wasn't trying to cut you off. I realizing that you're local, I wanted to give you as much time as possible. So I wasn't trying to cut you off at the end of the day today. But I saw you're from Douglas, and I thought if you needed more time, I'd be certainly willing to give it to you perhaps on Friday. So,
thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Any other comments from committee? In which case, I do need to say that... our next education committee meeting will be January 25, Wednesday, 8 a.m. It will be a joint meeting with the Senate Education Committee. Hear a presentation by the Alaska Early Childhood Coordinating Council. And I'll also be giving an introduction to HB 256, repeal of state intervention. It'll be a comment on intervention that I believe will lay a good foundation for all of us to... for all of us to build our discussion on, I really enjoyed the lively conversation, but we really do need to just be a little bit more orderly next time. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, one thing that I think a lot of people got a lot of benefit out of was your procedures last year of having the different communities or different districts make a short presentation to us, and I just hope that we will be able to work some of those in, because I know for me and others on the committee that was a very valuable asset, understanding of the local communities. So appreciate.
Thank you. I just Bruce Johnson's our coordinator. I spoke with him, but anyway, it's semester break. Teachers are being stressed. Superintendent's stressed now, but we were ready to do that this morning. So. Okay, with that, the Education Committee will adjourn at 10:05. See you on